Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Brash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Today's show brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox ships tasty and guilt-free snacks right to your door. With over 100 flavors to choose from, like Asiago and cheddar cheese crisps, pistachio power clusters, and Big Island pineapple, you'll never get bored of snacking again. You can try NatureBox for free. Go to naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. A lot of great feedback on the show from last week, the unscheduled rant cast that I recorded in the middle of the night. You never know which one of these shows is going to take off. I just sort of opened the microphone and vented for about 45 minutes, and I thought, oh, what the hell? I'll just put it online. You know, it'll be something to listen to. And I've got more correspondence from people who say, yeah, I was fist pumping in the car. I was screaming out the window, man. Yeah, go get him, Seth. It's good to see you riled up. It's bizarre. I mean, I just vamped it. You know, you can prep and write and create and pre-record and do this and arrange and schedule and guests, and you can do all this stuff and people go, oh yeah, that's a nice show. That's interesting. And you can just open the microphone and just bloviate for 45 minutes and people are like, that's the greatest show I've ever heard. So thanks for the kind words. It felt good. You know, from time to time, you got to get it off your chest. You got to release some steam. Anyway, if you're curious and you haven't heard it, it's called Coexist? And it's last week's podcast. Next week, we're going to do a random reason show. I'd like to do at least one of those a year where we just kind of mix it up, whatever you want to talk about. So if there's something on your mind, a fire in your belly, a theme or topic you are interested in, you can just email podcast@thethinkingatheist.com and we'll just sort of mix it up next Tuesday night. And then later on in the month of April, I am planning to finally release the audio of the Unholy Trinity Down Under speeches. That's me and that's Matt Dillahunty and that's Aaron Raw and the presentations we did in Sydney, Brisbane, and Melbourne. And those should be coming up in video and audio form in a few weeks, and the audio will make its way to the podcast here. So that's all coming later on in the month of April. Getting some feedback on a project I just posted in regard to Joshua Feuerstein. I normally wouldn't spend so much time on one guy or one issue, but he's been so popular. He just had a thing on Fox News. Fox News? Are you kidding? And he's been involved in this thing where I guess he called a bakery in Florida and he asked them to put an anti-gay message on the cake, to decorate it with an anti-gay message, and they refused. Well, he recorded the call with the owner without telling them he was recording the call, and then he put all that on YouTube. Well, Florida's a dual consent state, meaning both parties have to know the call is being recorded, otherwise it's against the law. So Hemant over at The Friendly Atheist was following that story, and I posted a video asking another question. Because Josh raised $20,000 last fall for the purchase of a Red One camera, and he's still shooting his videos with a cell phone. So it's like, what the hell's going on here? So I put that video up, and you can find it on the Thinking Atheist YouTube page or on the main page at thethinkingatheist.com. It runs about 6 minutes. I have not, to date, heard a response to my question from Joshua Feuerstein, so it should be interesting to see how all of that plays out. On the broadcast tonight, I've got several special guests for you. We're going to talk to Taylor Muse. He's the 31-year-old band leader and songwriter for Quiet Company. They're an indie rock band from Austin, Texas, hot on the heels of a brand new album out called Transgressor. Quiet Company used to deal in sort of spiritual issues, and now they challenge those spiritual issues. The band has sort of gone through a transition, and so have the band members. We're going to talk to Taylor about the whole thing in just a few. I've got George Dekus, one of the founding members of the hugely popular Christian group, the Newsboys. George is now an atheist, and he recently came out very publicly as an atheist. We're going to talk to him about Christian music, about founding a Christian group, the behind the scenes of the whole industry, and a whole lot more. And in just a second, I'm going to have a conversation with a guy whose name we're not going to give on the air. He was heavily involved with Christian music, and he remains sort of wired in to a degree. So we're not giving a lot of details because we don't want to sort of blow his cover, but he's been kind enough to go on the radio to talk about his experiences on stage with a major, M-A-J-O-R, major Christian group in the CCM just a few short years ago. So we'll have that interview in just a second. But first, I do want to say a huge thanks out to our sponsor. You know you're going to snack. You know it. And when you do, you want it to be worth it. Something tasty, satisfying, and that doesn't come with all the guilt. What you need are snacks from Nature Box. I've become a big fan. Over 100 healthy and crave-worthy options that are delivered right to your front door. All the snacks made with zero artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners, 0 grams trans fats, no high fructose corn syrup, and they taste amazing. Stuff like sriracha roasted cashews, white truffle popcorn, and peanut butter nom noms, to name just a few. Get smart about snacking. Right now, if you go to naturebox.com/thinkingatheist, you can start a free trial of their favorite snacks. Free snacks delivered right to your door. What are you waiting for? Go to naturebox.com/thinkingatheist to start your free trial today. As the product of a devoutly Christian home, CCM, contemporary Christian music, really provided the soundtrack to my youth. We were desperate to avoid the trappings of the world, quote unquote, the world. And so what we did was, is we sort of embraced this growing culture of music and musicians called CCM. And for a long time, I mean, this was definitely shoestring stuff. These albums were recorded with a lot of heart. I mean, I'll give them credit. These people really were giving it all they had, but they didn't have much. A lot of the albums recorded in basements and, you know, for about $1.50, and they were quite often ripoffs of what was happening in pop music at the time. And so when you would hear something that'd be a huge trend on pop and rock radio, give it a few months, and hey, look, there's a Christian version over here, and they look kind of the same, and they sound kind of the same, not as good, but kind of close. And so people would gravitate to that, thinking that they had sort of cheated the devil. Oh yeah, we don't need your music. We've got Jesus music over here. We've got guitar solos. We've got drum solos. We've got rock concerts with neon lights and flash pots and smoke and whatnot. And, you know, it's this whole thing. And especially during the 80s, you know, the time of the satanic panic of the 80s and early 90s, people were freaked about worldly stuff, specifically worldly music. I mean, there were churches who had album burnings, and they'd bring in rock albums from certain groups or bands, and they'd pile them up and they'd set them on fire in the name of Jesus. It's a little bit creepy, really, when you think about it. They're playing albums backward to hear satanic messages embedded in the grooves of the records and warning us about the evils of Alice Cooper and Iron Maiden and Black Sabbath and Judas Priest, and everybody singing about sex and darkness and drugs and rock and roll and violence and rock and roll. I mean, rock and roll became synonymous. We had a guy come to my school once, a Christian school, who talked about how the rhythms of the beats, the drum beats, were actually emulating drum beats of African tribes that were cannibals or something. I don't even remember exactly what he was talking about. It was just crazy. I mean, even those of us in the room thought, this is just bullshit. The drums emulated some sort of a ritual, but I can't remember the details of the ritual, but it was definitely evil. And so everybody was supposed to freak out. And so he wasn't even a fan of CCM. I once saw a revival service in Catoosa, Oklahoma, a little country church in a suburb of Tulsa called Catoosa. And he was an ex-Marine, big, burly fellow. He's out there wailing and carrying on about the evils of Christian music. Ah, CCM is just the devil. You can put lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig, that kind of thing. The devil's trying to sneak into your lives. They're calling it Christian music, but it's still them evil drums, and it's them guitars, and all them solos they're doing, and it's all just, it's sensory. It's, they're going after the flesh. It's what they're doing. And of course, his favorite music was country music. He populated his whole life with down and dirty, beer drinking, love him and leave him music. Well, that's just fine to him. You know, it's funny how people made their own personal preferences God's will. And this is indicative of how people populate their whole lives. They do something, and then if it feels right to them and it's a good fit for them, it's God's will. Which explains why people go to different styles of churches, right? You find more conservative people, they graduate to more conservative churches. You find the pew jumpers, these are the more flamboyant personalities, they gravitate to the Assembly of God Pentecostal. You can see them sort of finding what fits them personally and then saying it is God's will. But as I was growing up, we took a lot of pride in the fact that we weren't selling out to Satan. We were listening to, well, we were listening to Jesus music, and we'd play it as loud as we could around all of our secular friends, driving them absolutely crazy, I'm sure. I know I did. You know, we'd get them in my car, we'd go to lunch, a high school lunch, you get an hour off campus, we'd be driving to McDonald's, and I'd put in something on the tape player that was Christian, and I'd play it as loud as I could. I'll show those people, they listen to the devil's music, I'm going to surround them with Jesus. I'm sure I was the most obnoxious son of a bitch. I just want to go back and apologize to my friends when I was not. I'm sorry I subjected you to that. You know, it's not like they're going to hear that and go, you know, this is amazing. I'm going to forego all the stuff that I really like to listen to, and I'm instead going to do this. No one ever did that, and I just drove them nuts, you know. I remember back early 80s sometime, I was pretty young. My father had to drive me, so I definitely wasn't old enough to drive yet. But it was the Petra Beat the System tour that was coming to town, and my buddy and I camped out. We got, you know, there in the dark of night, overnight, and we stayed for hours and hours and hours and hours outside in front of the door of, like, Harmony Books, I think was the name of the place. They're long debunked. They're long folded and closed their doors. But we camped out waiting for the doors to open at 10 a.m. so we could go get front row tickets to go see Petra. And we show up at the show. We've got our concert t-shirts on. Our fists are in the air. You know, yeah, we're rocking out for Jesus, man. And there was a whole culture of this stuff. I knew a guy in high school, and he spent every dollar he had on Christian cassettes. I mean, you should have seen his room. I mean, he had these big cassette racks just stacked, bolted to his wall. There must have been hundreds and hundreds of albums of all different CCM styles. I mean, whether it was rock or whether it was pop or easy listening or praise and worship or jazz or whatever, the guy was crazy. And this had really become part of his identity. And the truth is, for a lot of us who were Christian youth, it really did become part of our identity. It was really the soundtrack of our lives. And, you know, it's funny because even now that I'm an atheist in my late 40s, if a CCM song comes on the radio or someone's playing it or I hear it somewhere from that era, it really does bring back a lot of fond memories for me. It triggers that memory. And I think, oh, yeah, I remember back then. I remember those people. I remember those football games. I remember those concerts. I remember landmark things during a landmark time in my life, kind of a formative time in many ways. It's funny how songs, music can really open those windows into the past, and you can really begin to experience in some way something you hadn't felt for decades or so. Do I listen to Christian music today? No. Many people ask me that. Do you listen to CCM today? And I say, no, you know, I just can't really enjoy it. Because even though the quality of the music is really, 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 really improved, I mean, major record labels jumped in and they really improved the polish, you know, and that started in the mid 90s and continues today. They've got the budgets, right? They've got the marketing departments. They've got the big producers. They've got the big names and the big sounds these days. But even though there's, you know, some quality in the production, I have a hard time listening to it because I think to myself, there are people who are just like I was, who are embracing this stuff as truth with a capital T. And they have closed themselves off from the rest of the world. And this music, in some way, sort of keeps them comfortable. And I don't want them comfortable. I want the world uncomfortable. I want people asking harder questions, challenging the lyrics of the songs. If they're positioned as truth, You know, let's challenge these and see if they really do have merit instead of embracing them because they make us feel good. So I can't really enjoy CCM much anymore. But it's interesting that it's continues to be one of the most popular formats in the United States. I have on the line with me a gentleman who was part of a very popular Christian band that continues today. For reasons of privacy, I'm not going to give his name here on the radio today, but he has been kind enough to lend his voice to the conversation and sort of give us a behind-the-scenes look at CCM. Thank you so much for being on the radio, my friend. How's it going?
It's going all right, Seth. How are you?
I'm well. I'm talking about sort of my old stomping ground, which is CCM, contemporary Christian music. And you've had some experience with CCM, correct?
I was the lead singer of a group in the early 2000s. I went on a large tour with about seven other bands all around the nation, all Christian artists of all different genres, and went through that tour over, I think, about 3 months and did about 20 cities and was in the industry and working on a record for about a year was my kind of experience in the CCM world.
Seven bands. Is it like a festival, like an all weekend thing or what?
It's not. Everybody kind of gets up and does a set in one evening and the show just travels from city to city and everybody kind of hears some stuff somewhere in that range of seven bands, gets to hear something they actually like and probably some other stuff they probably wouldn't like as much. So they do a pretty good job of having a wide array of different types of bands.
Now, we're kind of dancing a little bit around the names of the groups and the tours and whatnot. And I understand that's purposeful, right? You're not really wanting to throw the names out at this measure. You still have connections in the industry. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would say that's pretty accurate. And frankly, the main reason is that the people that I had direct, you know, that I worked with on that tour and had direct involvement with, there was nothing all that exciting or you know, any great stories to tell about it. They were pretty upfront about things. So, I think maybe just talking about the industry as a whole is kind of the direction I think would probably be most useful for you.
Well, the fact that there's not a huge story may actually be a story. I mean, we are eager sometimes as skeptics to look into the windows of Christian music and say it's all business, it's all money, and, you know, it's just an orgy when nobody's looking. It's booze and pills and sex, and it's just, and the truth of it is, actually, there are a lot of true believers in CCM.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, you can point to some of the larger ones and, you know, say they're the real deal. And then you can point to some others that have been around for a long time. And I remember when I kind of first got into it and came back home and learned what I had learned, I was still a Christian at that time. And I was very hesitant to really tell anybody about what I had seen and learned because I didn't want to ruin people's image.
Help me understand here. I'm a little lost. You had seen and learned about the industry and were becoming more skeptical, or you had become more about Jesus? Which way were you drifting when you're speaking about this time in your life?
Sure. So at that point, I was still a Christian. And when I was in the band, I was very much about wanting to not be inauthentic. And when I went out on stage, I had a conviction that, you know, if I'm going to be out here and I'm going to be a shining light for Jesus, and then I need to basically, you know, live my life a certain way and be able to back up what I'm saying. And living in Nashville, and the music scene in Nashville is very small, obviously, and so you meet a lot of people, you know a lot of things about people and learn a lot. And, you know, when you see someone that you grew up and their music was a big inspiration to you as far as in your faith and kind of see what their lifestyle is. Being that I was still a Christian, I didn't want to go back home and kind of ruin that for people. You know what I mean? And just kind of allow them to continue to have this idea of maybe what these people's lives were really like.
You're being very kind here. So let me see if I'm understanding you. What you're trying to say politely is that seeing people in three dimensions with all their flaws, you felt conflicted about going back, having seen kind of a messier version of these idealized icons, right? So you didn't want to ruin the party for those who still held these folks in high esteem. Would that be an accurate way to say
it? Absolutely. That would be an accurate way of saying it, correct.
Well, were you at all disappointed? Come on, we've all seen the airbrushed album covers, and we're like, yeah, I get a chance to go out and meet so-and-so and hang into so-and-so and play with so-and-so. And then you meet them and you see some occasionally unpleasant things. We're all human, right? It doesn't have to be the devil for his star to fall a little bit. And did you feel a sense of sort of like, holy shit, you know, this is, I've only seen the airbrushed. I've never seen the real.
Yeah, a little bit, you know, you know, I remember, as you probably well do, the first time Amy Grant decided to go and do a secular record, it was absolute. I mean, it caused a shitstorm in the CCM industry. And it's kind of one of those things in the CCM industry that you're either all in or you're all out. So, you know, going and seeing kind of what the industry was like and some of the lives of the people at that point in my life when I was still a Christian and with the incredible amount of judgment of people that goes along with that, I'm certainly a little bit disillusioned and disappointed with kind of what I had seen. So it definitely was an eye opener for sure.
You bring some memories back with that Amy Grant. Back then we called it crossover. I don't know what they call it today, but it was, and you can correct me if your perspective is different or your experience has been different. When I was in Christian radio and a fan of Christian music, we were desperate for legitimacy. A lot of what we were doing on the radio was a copy of what was happening in pop and rock radio at the time. We were on a shoestring budget. Very few people in the early days listened to our stuff. Very few people knew who Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith, Stephen Curtis Chapman were. And we were desperate to see a crossover happen where, you know, the artist got some play on a mainstream pop station, Amy Grant being the first to do that with what she used to call God or girlfriend songs. So it'd be a song about love. But if you played it on Christian radio, it could be about the love of God. If you played it on pop radio, it could be about the love of a girlfriend or boyfriend. And this was done intentionally by record companies to make it more mainstream, more palatable. And she actually successfully crossed over.
And probably even the bigger one for that, you make a great point as far as the legitimacy. And the big one was, in my recollection, was Michael W. Smith and that Go West Young Man record. And you could talk to your friends that weren't as hardcore Christian as you about this artist, and they would know who that is and what that song is. So that's exactly kind of how it was.
Well, you're right about the controversy. You know, you're selling out. You're watering down the message. There was a lot of that going on, sort of a fundamentalist culture versus a moderate culture inside Christian music.
Absolutely. And even down to the terms that you used, watering down lyrics. I mean, those are the exact terms that you know, we always heard about. And I mean, I remember there even being sermons in church and stuff about that as a kid when that stuff was happening, and basically, you know, encouraging people not to support them as artists and stuff like that. And so you kind of get that in your mind as far as what Christian music really is or is supposed to be. And then you kind of get into it and you find out that things are a little bit different.
You guys having an altar call from the stage when you were performing? Did you sort of lower the lights and lower the tempo and ask people to come forward and drop to their knees and accept Jesus Christ, that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. It was interesting because, you know, the way that these tours worked were they were funded by a company called World Vision. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, but if you remember the old Sally Struthers commercials, just 25 cents a day.
I don't know if Sally Struthers was she World Vision or was she another entity?
No, she was another one. I was just saying that it was one of those types of deals that you sponsor a child for X amount of dollars a month. And so midway through the concert, there would be exactly what you talked about. There would be someone that would come up and give kind of a very short message, and then there would be an offering. And actually, we were the band that would sing a song during the offering as the lights were lowered and all the things you just described. So
are you having the conversations? I'm not trying to push you into, you know, I'm not trying to create scandal where there is not, but I'm curious about conditioned response. Do you guys as a band have conversations? Which song is going to touch the heart the most? Which one will sort of emotionally bond them to the pitch more than another? Did you guys have those conversations?
No, I mean, not that specifically. And it was always the same song, but it was that type of song for sure. But it was never that implicit, when speaking about it.
One of the criticisms I heard even within the church about these highly charged concert experiences is that these bands would come in, and especially the ones who had had quote-unquote crossover success, and so they had non-Christians occasionally in the audience, and they would throw Bibles out, like Stryper used to throw Bibles into the audience, you know, and they would have the altar call, and then they would be counseled for about 5 minutes as they accepted Jesus Christ. And then the band would put everything back in the bus and the trucks, and they would leave for the next city. And these folks who had just made a life-altering decision, you know, in the heat of the moment, were left with no follow-up whatsoever. And that was a common criticism that I had heard by church members and others. I don't suppose you heard anything like that. Did you ever have any of those concerns? Hey, we ramped him up. We teed him up. We set the hook. Bye.
You know, I've heard of that kind of stuff as well. And there wasn't really a lot of that going on these tours. I think the productions, frankly, were just a little bit too big for that intimate of a type of a setup, I think. Yeah. So it was definitely spoken about, but it wasn't like you would see, you know, I would see at smaller concerts and stuff as a kid where they would do altar calls. These were shows in arenas as opposed to churches and stuff like that. So I think it, at least for this specific tour, we didn't really see a lot of that.
As you're on stage and you are performing, ministering, whatever, are the doubts really churning in you at that point?
I really didn't. It came actually quite a bit later. I think I always felt, different, I think, and I always felt just bad, I guess, is the only way I can put it. I felt worse than everybody else, I guess. And, but as far as my faith in Christianity and all those things, the doubt came much, much later, several years later, after I had already left the Christian industry and already had gone through my career in the secular music industry and really started after I was completely done with music.
Similarities between the two cultures, Christian, secular, is it all just business or what?
There are a lot of similarities, actually. The difference, I would say, is that it's much more honest in the secular realm, and the simple fact that everybody is out there for the same purpose, and that's to make money, and is very upfront about it. And the goals are the same in Christian music, but obviously with Christian music, you have this thing tied to the not only the entire industry, but your band and your legitimacy within that space in music that's tied to that. So you, the whole money thing is really, it's almost taboo to talk about it. You know, we hardly ever spoke about it.
So you want to sell records, but you do it in the context of, we want to reach more people. We want to minister to more people. We want to get it out there as much as possible. What you're saying is, we want to sell records. Is that accurate?
Precisely. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's all about the ministry you know, everything else is just kind of nice to have, which is obviously not the case. And I learned that very quickly. So
if we can put a punctuation mark on it, I mean, I know that these are nuanced situations with hugely complex circumstances and hugely complex people. But your perspective is not that CCM is all just fake. It's all just people selling product under the Jesus banner. There are some true believers in there, and there's good and bad to be seen and heard. Would that be accurate?
I think that would be very accurate as far as artists are concerned. You know what I mean? As the machine is very similar to secular music as far as, you know, these things aren't done for free. You know, you have to make money as an artist. You got to sell records. You got to get people to your concerts. The machine itself is very similar. And then the artists, it completely varies. You know, like I said, there are some that really are in it for the ministry piece, and it's very clear. And then there are a lot of people that are in it and either got in it maybe because they weren't good enough, frankly.
I was going to say it, but I was afraid to say it, right? I can't hack it on pop radio, so I'm going to go out and strike out in the Christian camp and see what happens.
Yeah, and it may sound cruel, but it's 100% the case. And you'd see it on many, many different levels. I saw it in many cases where people just weren't good enough. I mean, you know, you've spoken a lot about, you know, in other podcasts about copycats and kind of what you saw, and it's 100% correct. In fact, what we were doing musically was as a result of what was going on in mainstream music, and we kind of caught on too late. And by the time we had kind of, they'd kind of figured out, oh shit, we missed the boat a little bit on this. It was kind of too late. So no, it's absolutely the case. I mean, you've got an entire industry where the talent pool is much less than it is in secular world, because you got to find people that are willing to either have the ministry as their purpose or be willing to at least say it's their purpose. So yes, it's absolutely the case.
For reference, the speech he's referencing is called The Copycats. It's a presentation I did at ApostateCon in Omaha last year, and it's on YouTube. If I remember, I'll go back and put the link in the description box. But it shows example after example of how Christian culture, not just music, but marketing, retail of all shapes, stripes, and sizes, will continuously take the pulse of what's happening in pop culture and then turn out a Christian version of it in an attempt to, one, be relevant, and two, to sort of cordon people off and keep them out of the world. Why would you want to listen to secular music when we have the Christian alternative, that kind of thing? Thanks for sharing your perspective on the radio, being a part of the conversation about CCM tonight, and all my best. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Seth.
I had an email in from Edward. He said, I played music in one form or another since taking piano lessons when I was 9 or so. I played trombone throughout high school and college and taught myself how to play guitar and bass from around the age of 12. During and after college, I spent some time playing bass semi-professionally for several years and have only now just started playing and recording again. Growing up in my house and when we were driving around town, Christian radio was always on. This would take the form of either Christian radio-type talk shows, or sermons, or music from artists like Carmen or Sandy Patty. By the way, Carmen, I think, was diagnosed with a terminal brain tumor a couple of years ago, something like that. I haven't followed up on that story. I have to go look it up. Somebody said he had a miraculous recovery, but I hadn't heard anything else. I'm sorry, back to the letter, Edward. Even when I was a believer growing up, my older brother and I would always find great relief when we'd journey several hours away from our hometown, because this would be the only time my parents would allow secular pop groups on the radio. Probably just because they were too lazy to look up Christian radio in whatever podunk area we traveled to. As a result of this, I have fond memories of hearing the Beatles' Hey Jude and Johnny Cash, A Boy Named Sue, while on a road trip through Nebraska at a young age for the first time. When I got into high school, my first real girlfriend was a Christian from one of those non-affiliated, hand-waving-in-the-air, feeling-the-Holy-Spirit, prefab, corrugated, sheet-metal-type Baptist churches. Wait a minute. How could she have a hand-waving-in-the-air at an old-school Baptist church? That seems like an oxymoron. Weird Baptist church, anyway. He said she was a big fan of Amy Grant before she went pop, of course, and the Newsboys, etc. Admittedly, the closest I ever came to liking Christian music was when I used to be a big U2 fan back in the late 80s when they were accepted as being a quote-unquote Christian band in some circles. Oh, and maybe Stryper when they covered Earth, Wind & Fire's Shining Star. I'd occasionally play bass in her church's band. I remember playing Lost Dogs' Breathe Deep, The Breath of God at one point. Basically a Dylan Subterranean Homesick Blues ripoff. A bit later that summer, when she was preparing to go off to college, she was a year older than me, she dumped me because she said she'd prayed about it and that God had told her that this was all for the best. And how often does this happen in Christian circles? You know, I've been praying. This is me talking, not Edward. I've been praying about it, and the Lord, I think, is just leading me to a different place in my life. What a great out this was for people who wanted to get out of relationships. Instead of saying, what was that Jeff Foxworthy joke where he said, when someone says, I need some space, that's only half a sentence. The whole sentence is, I need some space without you in it. Yeah. Well, if you're a believer, you can say, you know, I just feel like the Holy Spirit is telling me that I need to back away and I need to get in touch with me. I need to get in touch with Jesus and the Lord and really focus on my relationship with Him, and then reevaluate my life to know what His plan is for me. It was beautiful. It was just an awesome out for anybody. Nobody really bought it. If you're on the receiving end, you're like, oh my God, this is a bunch of crap, right? They've already picked somebody else out. They're just looking for the exit door. But it sounded good on the surface. So when Edward said that, it just made me smile. Anyway, I guess this happened with his girlfriend. She dumped me because she said she'd prayed about it and God told her this was all for the best. At the time, I was devastated. But looking back, when she absolved herself of all decision-making responsibility by placing responsibility on her invisible sky friend, it really made me think about what I really believed, and it started me on my path to atheism. I'd started reading philosophy seriously a while before we started dating and had even stopped going to my parents' church before we met. But of course, love will make you do stupid things, so dating her made me stick with religion a bit longer than I probably would have without meeting her. Even after I'd stopped going to church, I was known as a reliable bass player around town, would often be called upon to play bass in various churches in the town when the pastor was trying to make the service more youth-friendly and would bring in more rock-oriented instruments to spice things up. I remember usually being promised a small fee for playing with the band, but in the end, I don't believe any of the churches I had agreed to play for ever paid me. They'd usually just make excuses until I forgot about it. Later on, after I moved to Ireland, I remember thinking when my nephew was in a regionally successful Christian band back in the early 2000s that I thought the whole label of Christian music was just a marketing scheme. It wasn't until I looked into it that I realized my suspicions were true. I personally don't mind when someone playing so-called pop music expresses their religion in one of their songs. It's only natural for any artist to reflect their innermost worldview when they create any type of art. But to stick a label on and distinguish it from every other type of music by calling it Christian is rather offensive to those of us who played music for over 30 years. I mean, if I had fewer scruples, I would have put on a vacant smile, ripped off the melodies from a few recent pop songs, changed the word baby to Jesus, and then sit back and watch the money roll in. Oh well, there's still time, right? Edward, thank you very much for the message. Amy said, though I grew up in the Catholic Church, I can't really remember a time in my life where I actually did believe. Having several older siblings, all of whom listened to rock music constantly, meant that I grew up loving music of all kinds, even the occasional playing of Spirit in the Sky, or Day by Day. I don't know if you remember the comedian Stephen Wright. He had the joke that went, "Last summer I drove across the country with a friend of mine, and the whole way across we had only one cassette tape to listen to, but I can't remember what it was." When I was very young, I remember driving cross-country in a 1972 Eldorado motorhome. And the only cool 8-track my father owned, in among the Lawrence Welk, Herb Alpert, and the Tijuana Brass and the Inkspots, was the original London cast soundtrack of Jesus Christ Superstar. That being the only palatable choice, my sisters played it constantly that trip. By the end of that summer, I could practically perform the entire rock opera on my own, my favorite part being Pontius Pilate. I'm sure there's some subconscious meaning to that for me. When I got a little older, the Christian rock craze was just starting to become popular. My older brother, whom I idolized, had a couple of friends from high school who formed a band they called the Sweet Comfort Band. No way! You knew the guys in Sweet Comfort? Their first album was cheaply made and only sold locally, but my dad rushed out to buy a copy not only because we knew a couple of guys in the band, but because on the album was a song they wrote in tribute to my older brother, who by that time had joined them in becoming a born-again Christian. I remember listening to an interview with the Sweet Comfort Band on a local radio station and the exhilarating moment they said my brother's name on the radio and explained that Ryan's song from their first album was written for him. This was so cool, I thought. And even though I had strong feelings of non-belief as a teenager, I'd still listen to that album over and over again, memorizing every song. I'm sure this is one reason why it was such a shock to my family when I finally came out as an atheist. But you know, music itself is so universal, it transcends any and all cultural differences, language barriers, or belief systems. To this day, both the soundtrack to Jesus Christ Superstar and that original recording by Sweet Comfort Band are still favorites in my music collection. and I expect they always will be, regardless of whether or not I believe in their message. Amy, thanks very much for the email. The Sweet Comfort Band. Man, that's a memory. I won from KCFO Radio in a contest the Hearts of Fire album, which I think was 1981 or 82, something like that. I remember my dad had to take me to the radio station, to the lobby, and I signed my little name there, and they gave me my prize, and I took my album, and I was a huge fan of Sweet Comfort. Saw them in concert, I don't know how many times. They eventually broke up. I think mid-80s, the band broke up. Randy Thomas, who was the guitar player, songwriter, he went off to be with a group called The Allies. And Brian Duncan, who was the lead singer for Sweet Comfort, went off and had a successful solo career. We had him on the radio, I don't know how many times, when I was on KXOJ. He's a tremendous guy. I always got the vibe Brian was a little jaded, like the industry had just really sort of toughened his skin. I think he enjoyed what he did. I think he was a true believer, but there was something about him that just looked weary. Like he was tired of all the platitudes. He was tired of the money. He was tired of the marketing. I think he just, and this is totally just me looking at the guy from across the interview sort of counter there, looking at him behind the microphone in the studio. But I just thought, you know, this guy looks like he's a little irritated at the business of Christian music. And I've always had that impression of Brian. But Sweet Comfort, I totally get you. You know, some of the older stuff. Isabel, she's a new creation. You're not alone in your situation. I remember having that album. There was a song that they did called The Contender, which was really big. And their Perfect Timing album is still a fad. If Perfect Timing came on the radio today, I would probably crank it up. Yeah, you know what? Maybe I would listen to Christian music again. Go figure. I wrote something in my book, Deconverted, about the industry and some of the challenges CCM had had with scandal. And I'm going to get into that in just a little bit. But first, I'm going to bring on my next very special guest, if I may. Taylor Muse is a frontman and songwriter for Quiet Company. They're an indie rock band in Austin, Texas. And he has some experience with the whole Christian music thing. And he's been kind enough to join us on the radio today. Taylor, thanks for being here, man.
No, thanks for having me on, man.
So you come from Texas, a highly religious culture, a highly religious family. Would that be accurate to say?
Yeah, I think so. From the Bible Belt. And I grew up in East Texas, which tends to be a little bit more southern in culture than maybe the rest of Texas.
What, are you doing music early, and is it Christian music or what?
Yeah, I mean, I started playing music, you know, when I was in, I mean, I got my first guitar when I was like 7th grade, and I probably didn't get to where I was like a functional guitarist till high school, and then I started playing the praise team and stuff at church, and started my first band in like freshman year of high school with like a couple other dudes from church. But I started leading worship at another church with my brother. We started working at this other church in kind of like later high school, and we'd started a band together, and I'd moved on from my first band. But we were still a Christian band. We're still very much evangelistically minded, you know, about everything we did.
The praise and worship band culture is kind of its own animal, isn't it? It's hard to put into words for those who haven't experienced it firsthand, but
yeah, it really, it is weird. Like when I was in high school though, it was kind of right before praise and worship became a genre. You know what I mean? Like it was,
I mean, before Hillsong and that kind of thing?
Exactly. Before like Passion and before, yeah, you know, all that stuff kind of like really hit. Like we had Delirious, and I still love Delirious actually. Like, yeah. I still would probably buy a Delirious record if I knew it was coming out. You know?
Yeah.
I just love that band. They're a great band. But like, yeah, Delirious was kind of like the only like big praise band, but they weren't really just a praise band. You know, like they were like a rock band that just kind of had this like praise and worship side. And then they'd write a song that kind of sounded like Radiohead. You know, it was weird. But all that, like, Passion, Hillsong, all that stuff hadn't really exploded yet. You know, it hadn't become, like, the norm for church service.
It just seemed to strike all of a sudden. You've got all of these kind of polished, packaged praise and worship brands out there, many of them touring,
yeah,
the country, even internationally, taking praise music outside church walls, having concerts, Hillsong being a great example. But, you know, Phil Wickham, Matt Redmond, those types of people, Kerry Job, praise.
Tim Crowder, Chris Tomlin, all those guys.
Yeah, praise music was kind of their thing, and it just ignited with the Christian music audience. Were you a part of that at all?
Not really. It's never been like a, like I appreciated it in the right context when I was a believer. Like I certainly, you know, we went to youth camp and summer camp and stuff like that, where there would be like this really super professional praise band that would, they knew the formula, they had it down, you know, and they knew what, how to push the buttons and stuff. So I certainly appreciated it at the time. And I still very much believe like a good song is a good song. Like I don't, regardless of what you're saying and whether or not it's true or relatable to me, like I can appreciate it if the melody's good, you know?
Yeah.
But it was never a genre that I spent a whole lot of time just sitting around listening to. I had to be in a certain kind of mood or in the right place in the right time for like the praise and worship genre to really grab me, you know. I was always a little bit more punk rock than that scene would allow for.
I had a Christian musician friend of mine talk about how that you could strike a cymbal at just the right time, just the right way to, in his words, enhance the worship moment for someone else. And of course, we're talking about conditioned response. When I heard you say push the buttons, I had to think there is some of that going on. You know, we start big, we bring it down, we sort of end with a lot of lush ballads, quiet moments, big finish.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that, those kinds of conversations going on, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that anybody in that genre would, I could honestly deny that there is somewhat of a formula. I mean, I think there are certain genres of music that kind of just, you know, for better or worse, and I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing, but it's like they do tend to be more structured, like they're applying a formula. Like country music is the same way. It's like you don't see a lot of people really pushing the boundaries of country music in some crazy way because they don't really want that. They want you to play the chords that they know elicit a certain reaction. And praise and worship music is even more structured in that way, I think, where like they know, you know, and I knew it then as well. You know, like I know what chords I can strum that are going to make you feel despondent or touched or whatever I'm going for. You know, like words they use, like there's obviously like buzzwords that you can like point out that are kind of in every other praise and worship song. Like it's a formula and it's, you know, I almost don't like, if I were saying that about any other kind of genre, I feel like it would be more critical. But I think because of what it is that they are going for, it almost kind of seems like almost like Eastern philosophy, that like this mantra or something, they're just trying to tap into something and they know this is the pathway to it.
Mighty good way to say it be that they consider it just an effective tool. We know that this tool used in this way helps to work.
Yeah, I think that's very fair.
Yeah. Talking here with Taylor Muse of the band Quiet Company, what was your role in contemporary Christian music, or was there a role? Were you a Christian, quote-unquote Christian musician in some sense?
I mean, I feel like nowadays you have a lot of people like John Foreman from Switchfoot and people like that kind of making really articulate cases against that terminology, you know, like people that are very much obviously in quote-unquote Christian music, saying like, well, you know, you don't consider yourself a Christian plumber. If you're a plumber, you're just a plumber, you know, and you know, if you're a Christian, then that's your own thing.
Yeah, well, you know, the Christian plumber is not holding an altar call after he fixes the pipes under your bathroom sink, you know, in the Christian culture. I mean, they're having people come forward and say the salvation prayer at the end of the night. I mean, it's kind of a different animal, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's very much a different animal. If that's where we're drawing the line, if we're drawing the line at whether or not your shows are evangelical, then no, we were never a Christian band. But if it's not as terse that way, if it's just about writing songs with spiritual imagery and from the point of a believer, then yeah, I guess we were, because that's what I was doing.
You don't sound very cynical for a guy who's been in the music business. I mean, I see and hear a lot of cynicism, especially from those who have been in the quote-unquote ministry of music.
Yeah, man, I appreciate that, actually. I feel like cynicism is one of the most useless things that we all kind of fall into from time to time, you know, and I feel like skepticism and cynicism kind of share a fine line sometimes, but I think skepticism is something that's awesome for us as people and society and just, for lack of a better word, you know, spiritually. It's a good thing for us, but cynicism, I don't think, is anything but destructive.
Yeah, I don't hear a lot of, they're all crooks, it's all money, everybody's faking it.
Well, I actually, after I did 2 years of college, I moved with the band that I was in at the time up to Nashville, which is Christian Music Headquarters. And in that time, I started running with some guys that were in some of the big bands that I'd grown up listening to. Like I got to be really good friends with this band called Bleach.
Oh, yeah.
That hopefully you know of, because they're an amazing band and they're even more amazing people. Like they're just like the best, most genuine dudes I've ever met. And they're certainly not faking it. They're not applying a formula to cash in on Jesus. Like there's none of, like those guys really just believe that and they're just out there doing their thing. You know, I certainly met guys that were in bands that I kind of grew up listening to, and I ended up being like, that guy's kind of an asshole. but that was pretty few and far between, you know? So, I mean, I think for the most part, I want to give people the benefit of the doubt, especially the ones that I've become friends with, like the band Bleach and the band Luxury, who are all like Orthodox priests now. Like, it's like, those guys really believe that stuff, you know, for better or worse. It's like, that's who they are. And they're very genuine with it, you know, and it really means something to them. So it's like, you know, I don't believe it, but yeah, those guys do.
So how does a praise band rocker from Austin, Texas end up a non-believer? I mean, give me the Reader's Digest version.
Man, I think it was a large part that was the move to Nashville, because I was just kind of like, Nashville is a very conservative place as big cities go. But it was my first time to be like really far away from my family and kind of out of my normal friend group. And it was a new time for me. I had just gone through a big breakup, like my first like really big breakup. And so I was kind of running away from that in a way. And I just kind of decided it was this time to reinvent myself. And I was kind of allowing myself to question things for the first time. And my sister-in-law's brother had given me this book by Tom Robbins called Skinny Legs and All. And there was just this one passage in it that kind of pointed out this really weird part of the Bible that I'd always just kind of accepted. And so it made me kind of reevaluate it. And once I kind of saw it from the outside, and I was like, wait a minute, this is crazy. This is a crazy story that I just kind of accepted, where clearly God is the villain. But, you know, I've just believed him as a hero the whole time. It's the book of Joshua. And so it kind of made me think, well, what else am I wrong about? You know, and I was still a Christian for a long time after that, but I discovered Kurt Vonnegut, who was a big player in this game for me, because I just became obsessed with that man. And I'm still like, kind of obsessed with that man. And and I had, you know, conversations, started having more friends. I think I was just more open to it. I was just open to questioning myself. And Mark Twain has a great quote, big song or title for him. It says, the easy confidence with which I understand another man's religion is folly teaches me to suspect that my own is also. Hmm. And it was that kind of mentality, you know, where I was just like, well, starting to realize how similar all religions are and how I've always had no doubts that the other ones were bullshit. And so maybe mine is too.
Talking here with Taylor Muse, you've written music about your non-belief?
Yes. Our last record that came out about 2 years ago, it's called We Are All Where We Belong. And it was basically just a concept record about what we're talking about, you know, just realizing you don't believe the things that you kind of grew up believing. And what does that mean for you as a person? And what does that mean for how you fit into the community that you exist inside? And
so it's not,
are you going to raise kids?
It's not, I hate God, you're all stupid. Kind of,
yeah, and that was a conscious decision for us, because we knew we did have this Christian fan base, you know, and a lot of our fans and friends and family, you know, believe these things, and it's not our intention to make everyone feel like an idiot or like that we think they're an idiot. And it wasn't our intention to really like have a big call to action, like, hey, everybody, make us the poster boys from disbelief, you know? That wasn't the intention either. We just kind of wanted to say like, hey, here's what we experienced or didn't experience, more to the point. And this is what we mean. This is how it feels. This is the disappointment. This is the anger. This is the peace, the hope that comes from accepting these things and just accepting who we are for not believing it and what that means for us as people. So we felt as long as we kept it very personal, then it wouldn't be alienating in some way. And we actually kind of found that turned out to be 100% right.
Yeah, that was my next question. If there was a lot of blowback from people who were thinking, hey, wait a minute, what happened to my favorite musicians kind of thing?
Yeah, none. Like, we haven't experienced any. In fact, like, the Christian response to it was really encouraging, because, like, we had a lot of people that challenge it, you know, obviously. But luckily, we were fortunate enough to have people that were kind of in the mindset of, hey, I really like this record. I don't agree with you, but I totally have been where you've been. You know, like, I totally like shared at least some part of this journey with you, and I just kind of came out on a different side. and which I think is great because it started that conversation. You know?
Yeah, people are, at least at that measure, people are talking. There's dialogue, there's discourse, there's
exactly
some back and forth going on. Real fast, tell me about the new album from Quiet Company.
It's called Transgressor. It's not really a concept record like the last one. It's a little bit more, it certainly has themes, but it's a lot more rock and roll, probably a little bit heavier, a lot more guitar oriented. I believe it's our best record to date. I'm very proud of it. We recorded it live. We used a producer. It's Matt Noveski from Blue October produced it. It was the most fun I've ever had making music to make the record. And I'm trying to get over being sick, so hopefully I can start playing these shows well.
So if I wanted to direct our audience to the band or to the website for the new album, where would I send them?
You just go to quietcompanymusic.com, or you know, you can get it on iTunes, Amazon.com. You can get it pretty much anywhere that music is sold.
Congratulations on it. Thanks for sharing your perspective as not just a former Christian artist, but as an artist. I mean, that's an exciting time. It's great to hear your perspective. Wonderful stuff.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, man.
Chapter 6 in the book that I wrote a few years ago called Deconverted is called Mysterious Ways, and it dealt with the fact that people in ministry, specifically Christian music, were supposedly part of a higher calling. You know, they are serving a higher power. And yet an objective look at their lives and their careers revealed that they were going through the same stuff that anybody else, anywhere else, was going through. You know, we were not immune to scandal. In fact, because it was Christian or religious or whatever, the scandals rocked us even harder, right? We were supposed to be immune. We're supposed to be in the world, not of the world. How do these things happen? How does scandal and tragedy affect somebody who's supposedly a blessed and protected child of the living King? How does this happen? And every couple of years or so, we'd have something that would just sort of rattle our cages in the CCM culture. And I wrote about this. I'll just read a few paragraphs for you directly. Tragedy and scandal mark the headlines inside the CCM world every few years, and the faithful would scramble to make sense of it all. I remember the 1982 Los Angeles plane crash of Christian songwriter and evangelist Keith Green. He and two of his children were killed, and a nation mourned. Ironically, the brand for his organization was Last Days Ministries. In 1985, Scott Douglas, lead vocalist for the Christian band Whiteheart, was charged with aggravated sexual battery and arrested for statutory rape, ultimately doing prison time and forced to register as a sex offender. The band immediately fired Douglas and spent the next year doing damage control. I remember seeing that concert live at the Mabee Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. As they actually stopped the concert and talked about the fact that the guy who had been on that very stage the year before was in prison for child molestation. How they didn't know. They were all scandalized by it. They were all shocked. They're praying for him. They're trying to move on. And the whole time I'm thinking to myself, as a believer, how did God allow somebody in his position of authority? How did God allow a minister who was influencing so many thousands, perhaps even millions of people, be a child molester? Yeah, how did he not sort of shine a spotlight and say, wait a minute, Houston, we have a problem. How did this happen on God's watch? It didn't ring true even then. Christian rap artist Danny D-Boy Rodriguez was shot to death in 1990 while leaving his apartment in Dallas. No motive for the murder was ever established. I don't think they ever found the shooter. CCM had a hugely popular Christian comedian, Mike Warnke, who claimed a sordid past as a hardcore drug user and Satanist priest in his autobiography called The Satan Seller. Proclaiming his salvation story worldwide and displaying genuine comedic talent, Warnke sold millions of albums and played to packed convention centers, parlaying his gritty tales of hypodermic needles, blood rituals, and Vietnam War stories into a multi-million dollar ministry, before being exposed as a complete fraud in a 1991 Cornerstone magazine article. And to its credit, the church policed itself in this instance. It was a Christian publication that did investigative reporting to discover that he was never a Satanist high priest. He never did all the things in the Satanist culture that he said he did. He totally made the whole thing up. By the way, he is still out there and still ministering. In 1994, Christian superstar Michael English admitted an affair with Maribeth Jordan, vocalist in another CCM group called First Call, and spent years in a penitent climb back into the good graces of the religious marketplace. English's career eventually recovered, if you can call it recovered. I think he's been on TBN and those types of shows. But First Call disappeared from the radar completely. I think the group just was shattered. Their reputation, anybody who brought up the name First Call, it just sort of poisoned the group, and they disappeared absolutely from CCM's radar. I personally conducted a phone interview, a radio interview with Michael English a few years after the scandal, and we sort of slogged through the obligatory questions about his past as he worked to sort of regain a foothold in CCM. You know, it's sort of he had to go through this gauntlet of penitence and apology to be able to reestablish himself as a Christian artist. A year later, in 1995, Christian icon and the Queen of Clean, Sandy Patty, she admitted an adulterous relationship, and the whole cycle of reclusion, repentance, and reemergence started all over again. Christian music's fresh-faced poster child, Amy Grant, announced in 1999 she was going to divorce 17-year husband Gary Chapman. And many of us in the industry had heard rumors of a connection with Vince Gill, her current husband. To be fair, a quite possibly platonic connection, but we were hearing those rumblings well before the divorce ever happened. So the marriage to Vince Gill the following year came as little surprise, and controversial headlines would continue into the new millennium. A fast-rising CCM pop group, Raze, would never recover after vocalist Jamarc Davis was convicted of statutory rape of a 14-year-old backup dancer. Popular vocalist Clay Cross would reveal an addiction to pornography in his 2005 autobiography. Beloved Christian artists Jennifer Knapp and Ray Bolts came out as homosexuals, sending faithful fans into frothy debate over the legitimacy of gays in ministry. Please know I take no pride or pleasure in recounting any of these controversies. It was painful to watch my profession and the lives of those involved rocked to the core. With each revelation, each headline, each shock to the system, the labels, artists, and fans did their best to bring sense out of the senselessness. They, in almost every case, were quick to forgive. Their hearts ached with the broken families and shattered reputations, and they struggled to filter the difficult subjects of death, temptation, sexuality, deception, judgment, and punishment through scripture verses and Sunday school lessons. One of my favorite artists for a great number of years was Stephen Curtis Chapman. Had a chance to see him, interview him, sort of cross paths with him in many regards. We weren't really friends, but I was part of the circuit of broadcasters that he would sort of do. You know, I had to do the rounds every time an album came out. And he was always just a wonderful guy. And it was in 2008. Stephen's daughter, Maria Sue, I guess, was in the driveway playing, and his son hopped in the SUV, didn't see the daughter playing back there, backed out, struck her, and she was killed. She was only 5 years old. A horrible, horrible tragedy and a heartbreak for any human being, especially a parent. It's just unthinkable to see something like that happen to someone else, religious or otherwise. We're all human beings, and I think we have to approach these things from a standpoint of compassion. We do, at some point, have to ask the larger questions of why a benevolent involved deity, a loving father figure who can do anything and be anything and foresee anything and prevent anything, would do nothing as a precious 5-year-old is so horribly taken from a mother and father. We watched that story just a few years ago, and these types of things do happen from time to time to people, including the people who are serving in CCM Christian music and ministry. They're just people. And I guess that's the ultimate point, isn't it? The sort of larger issue is that they're just people. You know, they're people who go through the same stuff that you and I go through. You know, they're flawed people who sometimes suffer the consequences of poor decision-making. They're people who have tragedy befall them from time to time. They have their ups and downs, their tragedies and triumphs, you know. And while they invoke God, essentially they are still sort of planted with the rest of us here in the real world. And I think that was the point I was trying to make in the chapter of the book, not to celebrate the horrible stuff that had happened to them, but to point out that, you know, there seems to be no God involved here. These are just people in an action-reaction environment. And all this stuff is explainable if you look at it in that context. Dan sent a message. He said, when you put out the call for people who've worked in Christian music, I knew I had to write. I worked at Integrity Music for 10 years. They're best known for the CCM genre of praise and worship music, songs you'll hear on the radio, but church-friendly. Some of Integrity's greatest hits include Open the Eyes of My Heart, Above All, especially when Michael W. Smith sang it, and the Hillsong music like Shout to the Lord. Later, Integrity branched out and purchased INO Records with artists like Skillet, Mercy Me, and an album by Kevin Jonas. As much as I'd love to be able to talk about the artist, Integrity never really had artists as such. We had singer-songwriters. In the praise and worship market, the songs were the selling point. The artists weren't as important. There's no dirt, no behind-closed-doors scandals that I knew of, just bad management at the end. Integrity was started as a church sheet music distribution company. The founder and CEO was an ordained pastor. We had required weekly chapel sessions every Wednesday morning. Somehow I managed to miss virtually all of them, and I was a practicing Christian at the time. After Columbine and September 11th, everyone seemed to jump on the Jesus wagon. Our sales went through the roof. We expanded dramatically, bought back all outstanding stock, and went private. Several years before I started, Integrity went public, which led to a massive layoff. Going private was a goal of the CEO. I was the art director for the e-commerce division, having worked my way up from web and graphic designer to creative coordinator to art director. We developed all sorts of things to boost sales. Some were successful, like an e-zine I co-created and designed. Others, not so much. Worship Kitchen, an iTunes-like service that worship leaders downloaded PDFs, tracks like backing music for soloists, videos, and songs, tanked. Churches were moving to Macs, and there was no Mac version of Worship Kitchen, and the PC version crashed more often than not. The beginning of the end came in 2008, around the time the CEO put his kids in key positions in the company. I have absolutely no proof they led to the failure of the company, but shortly after his kids started, we lost the Hillsong distribution contract. We weren't getting any royalties from Shout to the Lord, Hillsong's most successful song. We used to joke that whenever a new Hillsong album came out, our marketing copy should read, "Same great songs, incredible new order." We also distributed music from New Life Church, Ted Haggard's former church. The scandal involving Haggard hit pretty hard, too. Wages were frozen. The company managed to limp along on what e-commerce and church sales brought in. Some smaller departments disappeared. Then the big layoff came. July 22, 2010 was my last day, along with my supervisor and 15 to 20 other co-workers. The company continued to survive until the end of 2011, when David C. Cook bought the remaining assets and moved the company to Colorado. Now, almost 5 years after being laid off, I look back at the time spent at Integrity with a mixture of revulsion and happiness. Sometimes the place seemed almost like a cult. A lot of the staff treated the CEO like he was the second coming, that he could do no wrong. But I was able to finish my degree, thanks to their tuition reimbursement program. And the layoff planted the seeds of my deconversion. I'm now working as a graphic and web designer for a magazine and a proud atheist. On a completely unrelated note, I also used to work as a radio DJ from 1990 to 2001. We played a wide mix of music from jazz to alternative with classic rock and blues thrown in for good measure. We could probably talk for hours about our radio experience. Thanks so much for a great podcast and keep up the good work. Man, thanks for the message. Thanks for the insight into Integrity. I remember we played a lot of Integrity's music on the radio and I continue to hear a lot of it promoted out there even today. Janetta said, I used to play in Fast Forward, a Christian metal band in the 80s. Now, I am an atheist. Lucas said, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, in what felt like the center of the Christian music business, and I can't emphasize the word business enough. My father, after driving tour buses for a group which you may remember called the Imperials for some time, eventually became friends with a live sound crew and made a change from driver to live engineer. He later went on to tour with the group Whiteheart as their main live sound engineer, bringing my mother and I on occasion. After a short time with Whiteheart, he became their main studio engineer and co-producer. Although I'm almost certain the producing credit was never printed because of the over-inflated ego of one of the band's founding members. And he lists the member here, but I'm not going to go there. As Whiteheart's fame diminished, he's gone on to work with many other groups such as the Newsboys, Switchfoot, Twyla Paris, Amy Grant, and many others, mainly as an engineer. He works from time to time in the Christian music scene, but also does more folk music now, producing the no longer duo The Civil Wars. Forgive me if that was somewhat long-winded, but I felt it was important to my story to give a short description of my father's background in all this. As for myself, I found I was going to multiple churches, Bethel and New Song, to name a couple of the bigger ones, attending dinner parties, bouncing from studio to studio, meeting many people who I'm sure were big wheels in the industry. But in all honesty, I couldn't give a shit less who they were, with the exception of a very small handful who were actually good people. It didn't take long for me, even as a child, to realize that the churches, the prayer meetings, the men's Bible study groups, and so on were nothing more than a networking system used to make business deals about who was going to play or work on what record, while also bragging about the stuff they were currently working on at the time. And maybe after all the bullshit stopped, as an afterthought, they might try and shoehorn God somewhere in there. Another thing that was very fashionable in this crowd of God followers was that public schools were evil, and all those who were to be looked at in high regard would homeschool their children with, quote, supplemental teachings from a 1 to 4 days a week church program, depending on how much money you had. The more money, the more blessed knowledge from the Lord. I, sadly, was one of the homeschooled, if that's what you could fucking call it. It basically consisted of me putting a VHS tape in the VCR and watch a recording of a classroom, and if all goes right, I learned something. It didn't really pan out. I was mostly illiterate until the 8th grade, when my family could no longer afford to send me to the church programs and were forced to send me to the evil public school system. Furthermore, as a result of being homeschooled, until that point, I didn't have any friends, except the ones at the church gatherings and dinner parties, which I didn't have anything in common with, or more likely didn't want anything to do with me. Being non-socialized made it very hard for me to fit in, relate, or even just talk to other kids. I was 10 years old, or thereabout, when my father began to spend more time working, and my mother began to spend more time drinking and partying with her friends, leaving me with 3 brothers, a 6-year-old and twin 2-year-olds to look after, many nights greeted by an enraged father upon his return home. The mental issues I've accumulated and tried to deal with during my childhood through the present, I feel have been a result of, or have at the very least, were accelerated due to the Christian music business lifestyle. My family was built around this two-faced business, and it destroyed it. My mother and father's divorce was and still is a gaping wound for both sides of my family and has damaged my brothers and myself in different ways. My father and I have never had a healthy relationship and more than likely never will. My mother doesn't party anymore, but I feel what damage was done will never be fixed. I could write an entire book on the dangers of homeschooling and how it has crippled me academically as well as socially. At 28 years old now, I'm so grateful that after high school, I discovered people like Christopher Hitchens, Alan Watts, and you, Mr. Andrews. The knowledge and healing I've received from you mean more than anything in the world. Thank you for helping me along. Lucas, thank you so much for an amazing message. Well, if I may, I must say that I think that homeschooling in the proper context, done the proper way, can be done well and can be a positive part of a child's life. And there are a whole lot of variables in there. We've talked about homeschooling in the past. I think your beef is probably the same beef I have with religious homeschooling. They exist not to focus education. They exist to isolate and insulate, essentially make little pod people that are never sort of exposed to the real world. And by the time they quote-unquote graduate, they're completely dysfunctional. They have no idea how to really go out and connect and relate personally and or professionally. They have no idea how to handle the opposite sex or the same sex or whatever, you know. And those environments, you and I are totally on the same page. But don't, I wouldn't indict all of homeschooling. I think there are a few exceptions to that rule out there. And there are those who do homeschool and do it well and socialize their kids who can speak to it much better than I can. And certainly a conversation, I think, worth having on that issue. But Lucas, I'm glad you escaped and I'm glad that you sort of found your own voice out there. And thanks for sharing that voice with us tonight. My final guest on the radio was a founding member of one of the most popular groups in Christian music. He's no longer with the band, but he has recently come out very publicly as an atheist. All the way from Australia, he joins me tonight. His name is George Perdikas. George, thanks so much for being here, man.
Thanks for having me.
You are one of the founding members of the Christian musical group, The Newsboys, correct?
Yes.
What year did that happen?
Well, we officially started in 1985. But I met Peter Furler at high school in 1981, and we became friends, and we used to jam together. So it officially started in 1985.
I don't remember the year, but during the Love Liberty Disco Tour, my co-host and I were part of a promotion where they took all these radio hosts from around the country, and they flew them to New York, and we met up with the Newsboys and had a concert there, as I recall. And then they put us on like a boat and they sailed us around the Statue of Liberty with the Newsboys on the boat. We're all hanging out. We're doing their thing. Everybody's schmoozing everybody else. And it was a lot of fun. I thought the guys were, seemed like nice guys, terrific guys. Obviously, everybody's got their game face on, but they seem like genuinely good people. Yeah.
Yeah, they are genuine people. They're just like everyone else. Except they have to abide by the rules that are set in the industry.
Tell me about the days when things really started to take off for the Newsboys. You know, things really started to skyrocket.
Well, we first came over in 1987, and we pretty well exploded straight away as far as playing the Christian music festival circuit. And, you know, I spent a good couple of years over there. I went over a couple of times with the boys and played all the festivals. We played everywhere, all around the States, touring around in a little van. And so the band was making its way pretty much straight away. We were Aussies, of course, and that was in our favor. I remember playing all these Christian music festivals, and we were just, you know, it was just going off. I remember one gig we did at the Atlanta Fest, I think it was, and we got a gig there and played in one of the smaller tents. And it was packed out, and the next night they put us on the main stage. So that kind of vibe was happening pretty quickly.
You guys had a real energy about you. There was something unique to the Newsboys, at least in Christian music. Most of the artists that we had seen, they're pretty tame and tempered. We had our Amy Grants and Michael W. Smith, you know, Stephen Curtis Chapman, those types of things. The Newsboys, you guys were just high energy. There was just a real sort of electricity about you guys.
Yeah, there was. We used to push the drums off the stage and climb on top of the PA stacks. And high energy. You know, from Australia at the time, you know, that was that kind of vibe going on here. So when we came across to America, our performance was probably as good as our songs that we had. So, yeah, it was quite a high energy band.
So while you're on stage, were you at the time a true believer? Were you navigating doubts?
No, I was a believer. I officially became a Christian at the age of 15, where I gave my heart to the Lord and did that whole thing. But I always believed in God as a child. It wasn't until I went to this Christian school where I heard that I had to officially become a Christian by saying this prayer and inviting Jesus into your heart, forgiving your sins and so forth. So I always believed in God. So I officially became a Christian at 15. And so when I was in the Newsboys, we were all fair dinkum about what we were singing about, and we really did believe it.
Did you have altar calls at all at your concerts? I know some artists wanted to do that as part of their evangelism, and some were just content to go out and enjoy the great music and then call it a day.
We did. We did that when we were doing our first few gigs. We started that before we came to America. We did that, but if we did a pub gig, we wouldn't do that.
So at the pub, yeah.
Well, you're right. We did that whole scenario.
And you felt like you were doing God's good work, right?
Yeah, we did. We thought we were fair dinkum about it. We thought we were doing the right thing. And I'm sure a lot of those guys still feel the same. But, yeah, it was basically a church service, just, you know, with a rock band. And it wasn't really rock and roll to me. Rock and roll to me is like AC/DC.
Yeah.
It's just a different thing.
What was your ticket out of religion? Was it just sort of the reality of being inside the music business? Was that part of the equation for you, or was it something else?
My interest in science was a big catalyst for changing my perception. It was a mixture of my interest in science and just observing the behavior of not just Christians, but other religions as well. I was interested in psychology and trying to understand how the mind ticks and so forth. So it was a combination of everything and life's experiences. And I just came to the conclusion 7 years ago that I'm going to exercise the power that I have within and start thinking for myself.
So as you look at people who are now on the front lines of contemporary Christian music, CCM, I mean, do you think or do you know there is a significant percentage of people who are not Christians who are still, quote unquote, ministering from the stage? Is this a thing?
Look, there's people in the industry that aren't Christians, that it's just a job to them. What frustrates me in the Christian music industry is how people proclaim to be one thing but behave a different way. And I'm an atheist now, and I'm an honest atheist, and I can't behave the way these people do. And again, the Christian music industry is an easy target to exploit money out of people. And you could see how, you know, any sort of con man would be drawn to that kind of thing.
Are you still doing music in some capacity, George?
I haven't stopped playing music. Music is what I do. I've been playing the pubs and club scene in Adelaide mainly. Since I've left the newsboys, I've done about 2,500 gigs. So I've played to all kinds of folk, all kinds of religions, all kinds of races. I've met a lot of beautiful people out there. And that was another kind of like it was very educational for me to do that, because you get to meet real people with real issues. And, you know, in the early days, I'd met people that got married and, you know, they'd come to gigs, and then you'd see them 10 years later, they're divorced, and then they'll meet new people, then they come to gigs, and then they'll stay together for another 5-10 years and they may divorce. You see people's personal lives from the stage. You realize that, you know, we all have psychological sort of issues, but at the end of the day, we all gather around and we help each other.
Who was it who said that there's no normal life, that there's just life? I've come to sort of appreciate that, right? There's no such thing as a normal life. There's just life.
Yeah, exactly.
That probably helped you to see people in three dimensions. When you're inside the church culture, it's easy to become sort of judgmental or even afraid of those who are different than you. And yet you being exposed to so many different environments, so many different types of people, probably was part of your extrication from religion. Yes?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was kind of like just observing human behavior from the stage. You almost become a psychologist just by observing people gig after gig. You see people at their best and worst, fueled by alcohol. And yeah, it's quite an experience.
It's funny, in my youth, I had this impression of the music industry, of the music business being glamorous. It was much like radio. Oh, radio's so glamorous. And of course, when you get in there behind the scenes and you see what it really is, the glamour sort of dissipates. And I'm sure, you know, if you played as many gigs as you have and as many places as you have, you've been hauling a lot of gear at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you've been on a bus or in a car or doing some very unglamorous things to support doing what you love. Yes?
Correct. And the only thing that keeps me going is the fact that I love to play guitar. And I also love to put a smile on people's faces. And that's what it is for me. If I can go home and I've put a smile on someone's face from the gig, then I've done my job.
Music seems to be a unifying force. It just brings people together.
Absolutely. You know, if you're at an AC/DC concert, you can have 4 different people from different countries and different nationalities speak different languages, but if they're all wearing the same T-shirt, they will unite. It's a very powerful force.
George, you've done some interviews lately about your atheism, and you have been at least mildly critical of much of, or at least some of, contemporary Christian music. You're putting yourself out there these days. What's that about?
Well, it's part of the Newsboys story that needs to be told. I was with the Newsboys for 5 years. That's a big chunk of the story.
Has anybody in the Newsboys actually contacted you or spoken to you about your non-belief? Anybody trying to pray for you or convert you? Any of that stuff going on?
A lot of people are trying to pray for me. Peter Furler, he knows my heart, and he thinks I'm more Christian than most Christians. So he's not trying to convert me. He knows who I am.
I mean, these guys aren't pissed off that George is out there stirring the pot and making waves and associating the Newsboys' name with atheism. You're not catching any of that blowback?
Maybe from the management side, but that's another story.
Yeah. Well, if you were in the green room and, any number of Christian artists walk in and sit down next to you, are you talking people out of their faith? Are you just happy that everybody's happy? What do you think?
Well, I played with Peter Furler at Easter Fest at Toowoomba a couple of years ago, and he had Paul Coleman and a couple of other ex-Newsboys members playing with him as well. So we all got together and we were in the green room and hanging out with all those people. And there was a few people that were aware of my current perception. And I remember before we went on and played, they prayed, Peter and the other members of the band, but I kind of was just on the side. And then when they finished, I said, okay, can I say my own prayer now? And I just thank the universe for these wonderful, awesome blokes. And they kind of looked at me and were dumbfounded. I think they were speechless when they did that. So they're aware. I had no problems telling anyone. I'm not ashamed.
Are you in a good place? Are you happy? Is the universe aligned for you, man?
You know what? I'm in the best place of my life at the moment. I just feel real inner peace. I feel connected with everyone. I don't feel separate. I don't go around with this perception of viewing life through a veil of separation with one another. I understand science, that we're all made of the same elements. And the story of science is such a majestic, poetic outline. It's far more spiritual than any religion. So I feel great. I feel connected. I love people. I want to help people. I want to be compassionate and empathetic and put out some good energy while I'm still on this planet. We're only passing through. So, I just want to get out there. I'll always play music. I'd like to play with like-minded people always. I'm still just as passionate as I was when I first started. And I just love playing the guitar, love playing music, love smiles on people's faces. So I'm in a great place. I don't feel separate from the universe. I feel like I'm part of it.
George Perdikas, one of the founding members of the Christian music group, The Newsboys. George, thanks for your time. And for what it's worth, man, I thank the universe for you because you're just awesome. All right.
Well, thank you for having me, Seth.
So many great messages and emails I could not get to tonight, but thanks to everybody for sharing your perspectives and story. It's a complex issue. We may cover it again in a year or two and kind of see what else is happening in the world of CCM. Now that the show is over, it means it's time you can get free snacks delivered to your door from Nature Box. With over 100 options to choose from, you can get the bold flavors you crave and feel smarter about snacking. Just go to naturebox.com/thinkingatheist to start your free trial tonight. naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. And I'll see you next Tuesday for the Random Reason radio podcast. We'll see you then. Take care.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. thethinkingatheist.com.